Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Well, it's a busy show today. First of all, we'll be talking electric cars. It's government policy that 10% of all cars should be electric by 2020. But where do we stand exactly on electric cars? Well, I'll be talking to Declan Wynne. He's general manager of Gale Tech. That's an Irish company that's recently won a contract to install electric car power points in Irish homes. Now, the source of human and animal intelligence has always been controversial, but we've been looking in the wrong place, apparently. Later, I'll be talking to a leading expert, Professor Brian Ford from Cambridge University. He was in Dublin during the week. Well, he believes that the root of intelligence lies inside each individual cell. First up, though, we're going to be talking about the Burren. Well, that's the magnificent landscape, of course, in the west of Ireland and some of the threats to its continued good health. Well, to talk about some of these and the Burren in general, I'm delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Sharon Parr. She's a project scientist with the Burren Farming for Conservation Project. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, good afternoon.
How you doing? Now, maybe for those, I'm sure most of our listeners know about the Burren and probably have been there, but for those that mightn't have been down there, tell us why the Burren is so special.
Well, it's special from lots of points of view. I mean, it's a very iconic landscape in Irish terms with the limestone, but it's got a wide diversity of habitats, and because you've got a lot of habitats, it's very important for wildlife and for flowers. It's also really, really important in terms of its archaeology. It's probably the best preserved archaeological landscape in Ireland, if not in Britain and Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And it looks very unusual, doesn't it? I mean, it's when you go down there, it's very much stone, and there's hardly any trees, and it's very different.
It is. It's a limestone landscape, and of course, what you see most of the time that jumps out at everybody is the bare limestone rock, and you tend to think that it's a very barren landscape, but it's not, because within the limestone itself, there's lots of grasslands, heaths, there's hazel woodlands, there's wetlands. So it is very distinctive from the point of the rock, but there's much more if you look at it closely.
Okay, and could you? I know it's a long story, but could you kind of summarise how it came to look the way it does?
Well, nobody is fully sure. There's a lot of conjecture. I mean, if you go back sort of 6,000 years ago, man arrived really in the Burren. He probably started farming, and the impact of farming was to remove a lot of the tree cover that was here, and certainly that caused soil erosion in certain places. So over the years, agriculture would have changed and adapted to the requirements of the day. So in some ways, some people would say it's a degraded landscape, but it's still a very, very important landscape.
Okay, I could be totally wrong, but I was under the impression that maybe it was ice that had come in during the Ice Age and it just cleared out all the soil and the vegetation and left very little behind.
Well, the ice did certainly have an impact. It's what gave the limestone hills a very terraced shape that's very distinctive of them. But also water had an impact. And there's two theories. Sort of, there's the theory that the ice did scrape off the soil and didn't leave much behind except in the valleys. But there's the possibility that it did leave a very thin layer of soil on top of the hills as well. And it probably did in some places and not in others.
Okay. And that soil disappeared how? It just, is there any idea of how, if there was a thin layer?
Again, it's one of those things where there's lots of theories and no full proof. Because the soil itself often was derived from limestone, and limestone's soluble because it's an alkaline rock. It's soluble in rain because rain's slightly acidic. It will have dissolved. It will have got washed through the grikes, which are the fissures in the limestone itself, and into the network of pipes and caverns that are under the Burren.
Sure. Okay, so there's a lot to still be learned. Now, you're with the Burren Farming for Conservation Project, so that would imply that there's a few threats to the good health of the Burren, I would imagine. So maybe, what are the threats?
Well, I mean, the big problem is the Burren is very much a landscape that's maintained by traditional farming practices, and all the rare flora and fauna that you get in the Burren is really quite dependent on the continuation of traditional grazing. And in the Burren, what happened there was stock went up onto the uplands, which aren't very productive, and grazed there for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely essential. But with changes in agriculture in the last 40 years, that led to changes in livestock, and that led to changes in the way they were fed and managed. So a lot of these important winterage areas where we get most of the diversity in both flowers and insects have become underused or abandoned, and they've become very rank. There's a lot of scrub encroachment going on.
Yeah, we're in Dublin here, so a lot of people mightn't be familiar with farming practices or whatever. But so there was a kind of a balance between the way agriculture was done and the landscape that's changed.
Yes, very, very much so.
And the animals then that were grazing, that helped to clear out the weeds or whatever, was it?
Not the weeds. What had happened is that the animals had spent the summer down on the deeper, so more productive meadowy type pastures in the valleys. And then during that time, the grass and the flowers on the winterage areas, which are quite low productivity, they'd get to grow sort of unhindered by grazing. So they'd grow, flower, set seed. But if you don't graze off what the vegetation that grows over the summer and you leave it over time, that builds up in a thick layer, and that blocks out the light from a lot of the important plants. What the cattle did was they essentially were put up onto the top of the hills and grazed what's really a standing hay crop, and that was the key to keeping the sort of lots and lots of flowers on the winterage area.
And I would imagine that the farming has become more intensive then, hasn't it, in recent years? In other words, that you pen them in maybe and try and have more productive agriculture?
It has. It's become much more focused on the green land and a lot of farmers, because it's really, really hard to farm up on the
to make a living
areas. Well, both physically to farm it, because it's difficult to get into these areas, and you have to remember the cattle are up in the winter. So if you've got cows calving in February and March and you're trying to get out to them up on the winterages, you could have to walk a mile or two to find them in a very rough landscape. The only time you're going to be able to do it in most cases for farmers is of an evening and a weekend, because there's so little money in farming in the Burren that most of them have off-farm employment.
Okay, and at the moment then, how serious a threat is the change in agriculture to, say, the balance of everything in the Burren, the plants, animals, the humans, everything?
Well, it is very serious from all points. I mean, you could see the changes whereby a lot of winterages have become very underused, so you were getting a lot of rank grassland developing, a lot of early scrub encroachment coming in. But it's also leading to the knock-on effect, because the landscape is the sort of the foundation for a lot of things that happen here. The tourism, for example, people come to see the iconic limestone landscape, not it covered in bushes. And it's quite interesting talking to tourists who've been in recently, who were here 20 years ago, and they're seeing the difference and saying, can't anything be done to stop the bushes? So tourism is very dependent on the farming keeping the landscape, but also the communities are very dependent on farming here, because it's the main employer, really. So if you lose farming and people start moving away, the communities break down.
So it's a tricky situation,
it's
really.
It's a very tricky situation.
And just for people listening that might be going down to the Burren during the summer, is there anything they should or should not do just to make sure that everything remains okay and conserved?
Well, I think really in terms of people coming down, it's to respect the landscape themselves. There's certain things that happen with people who come down, such as where they see the rock and they'll start pulling it up and making their own little mini dolmens and that sort of thing. That's done quite a lot of damage in some tourist areas, and also to be aware of the archaeology, and to be aware that when you go into the Burren, it's not all national park or all commonage. It's actually most of the Burren is owned, so you're going onto other people's land, and the farmers of the Burren are great. They generally don't mind, but it's to respect that land, and if there are livestock around, which generally there aren't on the winterages at this time of year, it's just to be careful of them, especially where you've got cows and calves present. But the other thing you can do is to support the local businesses, because, again, they keep the communities going. And the other thing is people might be interested in contacting or joining the Burren BO Trust, which is a charity that's been set up in the area to look at conservation.
BO Trust, is there a website?
There is.
What is it?
www.burrenbeo.com.
Okay, that's great. We've just run out of time there. But thanks very much for coming on, Sharon, and telling us all about the Burren and its situation at the moment. That's Dr. Sharon Parr. She's project scientist with the Burren Farming for Conservation Project. And just anybody going down there, some good words of advice for the summer. Okay, now just before we queue up our next guest, just an item of news. In Science Now, which is the news section of Science Magazine in the USA, it's reported yesterday that heart attacks, of course, this is one of the main killers. They kill because they strangle heart muscle and they destroy cells and prevent the organ from pumping properly. It's a major killer, of course, in the States and Ireland, all around the world. But quite amazingly, it's been reported that researchers can now coax hearts to heal themselves. So what they've done is they managed to, this is within mice, of course, it hasn't been done in humans yet, but if it's been done in mice, which are very similar to us in many ways, then the hope would be that it would go into human clinical trials and it could be used for humans in the coming years. What they've done is they've nudged cells, or they've kind of pushed them in a certain direction within mouse hearts to repair some of the damage that has occurred there. And this might prompt a new treatment for heart attacks in humans, where you could actually prompt the body to cure itself, to trigger the cells that have become damaged actually to repair themselves. And of course, this would be a major advance on surgery, because surgery comes with all kinds of risks and all kinds of potential complications. So that was just an interesting item there that caught my eye. Okay, next we're going to talk about intelligence. Well, intelligence has always been controversial in the sense of what exactly is intelligence, and also what is the root of intelligence, where does it come from? Well, today we're going to be talking to Brian Ford, Professor Brian Ford of Cambridge University. He was speaking in Dublin yesterday. Well, he actually believes that the root of intelligence must lie in individual cells. Welcome to the programme, Brian.
Oh, welcome. I mean, very nice to be here. Yeah, I've only just realised we're not recording. This is live.
Yes, you're God live. Heaven. You're live. Well, you're talking to the people of Dublin now. So you were.
I can tell you, I've been talking to the people of Dublin for the past 4 days.
They like talking.
Don't they just? We have had the most wonderful time. I always really enjoy coming to Dublin. And this was the perfect place to come and launch this theory.
Absolutely. Okay, now tell us, when we're talking about intelligence, we generally think of intelligence as a macro thing that affects all of our brain. But you have a theory that the root of intelligence lies in each individual cell.
Yes.
So you spoke yesterday, I think, about that in Dublin. So
yep.
maybe enlighten our listeners on what you believe.
Well, it's interesting what you say. You know, when you say how we define intelligence, and everybody who's listening to your program will know there are dozens of ways of defining intelligence, and most of the people who adhere to one definition would argue to the death with the people who adhere to another one.
Yeah.
But I did a review of the definitions of intelligence a year or two ago, looked in lots of sources, both online and the traditional published ones, and they all have a single common strand,
mm-hmm.
and that is that somewhere in the definition, they always say that it is the ability to adapt your behavior to rectify an unforeseeable situation.
Okay, be adaptable, which is
yes.
a basic human trait.
To respond yeah. in an intelligent way to something you didn't expect to happen.
Okay, learn from your mistakes, would that be?
Sort of, yes. But one of the examples I showed in my lecture, which was filmed by a great friend of mine, Dr. J. Pickett-Eeps in Melbourne, but it's been known since the Victorian era, it's just that he took the best pictures of it, and the interpretation on the pictures is entirely mine, is this. You can find red algae. The one we've been studying is Antithamnion. It grows in tropical seas.
Mm-hmm.
And it forms, it's a filamentous alga. It forms sort of plumy, feathery growths. But the cells grow like the carriages of a carriages of a train, you know, end-to-end
sure.
join. Now, what you can do is this. You can get one of these filaments on the microscope slide, and you can then cut right across the one in the middle with a steel knife.
Mm-hmm.
So it's broken. The cell wall is as broken as if you've cracked an egg and tipped out the contents to make an omelette. You've got two empty bits of cell wall, but both facing each other.
Okay.
And the question is, what happens next? Well,
yeah.
it's obvious what happens next. You think, well, you've broken the chain. That's the end of it. You've now got two chains of red algal cells instead of one, and they've got this rather raggedy bit at the end. But that's not what happens, Sean, when you watch them.
Mm.
And then when you play the video back, speed it up 30 times, what you see happen is this, that the two cells on either side of the break realize what's happened. I'm crooking my fingers when I say realize, because you don't know what that means for cells.
Sure.
And they begin to move into the empty space.
Mm.
Then they meet in the middle, so that this completely emptied out cell wall that's just full of seawater has suddenly got protoplasm, a living cell, back in it again. And then, and this is where it gets really interesting, they move the cell walls back into alignment, and they seamlessly mend the break.
Okay.
Now, hang on a second. The only way in which these filaments are going to be broken in nature is if a rock falls from a glacier, or a dinosaur stamps on it, or there's a sudden flood, and in which case the filament is going to go ping like broken elastic, and both ends of the broken cell walls will end up miles away from each other.
Yeah.
The only place ever where you could find the filament broken and the two broken ends of the cell walls lying facing each other, next to each other, is on a microscope slide. These cells are faced with a situation they can never, ever have experienced in nature. It's nothing they could have evolved a mechanism for.
They can't have learned this, or...
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that they have to, and again, I'm not sure what we really mean by this, but they have to kind of sense what's happened and then work out a stratagem. And so they react, just as in the definition of intelligence I mentioned to you earlier, they react in a way that means that they can rectify this unforeseeable damage.
Mm.
And you really see the roots of intelligence. And these are in algal cells. I mean, you know, you think of algae as being slime in a pond. Now, if an algal cell...
can do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
If an algal cell can do that, does it make any sense in the world to assume that the human neuron, which is the most highly evolved cell we know, and indeed neurons are so highly evolved they've even done away with the ability in the ordinary fashion to reproduce, and I can promise you from personal experience that doing away with the interest in reproduction is only something you do if you're really, really specialised, whether you're a cell
yeah,
or not.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to do it.
Absolutely, but I mean, thinking to yourself that you've got a neuron in your head, and our current model of the brain is that the neurons are like transistors, like a go or no-go gate, an on-off switch, and that the decision-making is done at the synapses, you know, where the dendrites and the axons from the neurons, the side branches, meet but don't quite touch. Well, I do not accept that if a lowly algal cell can work out how to put its neighbor back to life and mend the damaged cell wall, I don't accept that the highest, most organized cell that we know, the human neuron, is just going click on or click off.
Sure.
My model is that the cells in our brain, the neurons in our brain, are actually processing data inside themselves. Each one is a kind of a thinking organism. Each one is making its own decisions. So it's not true that the brain is sort of a huge computer full of all these neurons which are transistors or chips. No. Each neuron is a computer. The brain is a community of computers.
Right.
I mean, computers is a very bad analogy.
And why then do we have, why do we seem to have people, you know, which are obviously, they have a brain and a community and whatever. Why do people then, some people seem much brighter than others?
Probably because of the way, well, there are two reasons why some people feel brighter than others. One of them is because the genes that they inherited from their parents has actually created for them a sort of a better organized community of neurons so that they can, you know, think things better than the others. But the second mechanism, of course, is whether they've actually been taught anything. An awful lot of kids go to school, hate it, can't stand the teacher, don't like the lessons, can't see the point, and end up as dull as ditchwater. But if you would inspire them and make them excited, then, of course, their neurons would soon get used to all of this frenetic activity, and they'd end up a load brighter. I've known a lot of people, I bet you have too, in fact, all your listeners have, who, when they were in school, were, you know, dull, sort of, whatever-ish kind of teenagers.
Yeah.
And then our brain surgeons and judges and taxi drivers with an encyclopedic memory, because later in life, they suddenly acquired an interest. And once that happens, all your neurons spring into life and start thinking and working things out and enjoying life much more than they did.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. I'm sorry we don't have more time to give it. We'll certainly have you back on the program to give it more time.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, that'd be fun. And you know, it'd be great to have you on for a little bit longer. But you were in Dublin. You were speaking about the genius of the cell, how there's intelligence within each particular cell. And thanks very much for coming on and telling us all about that. That was Professor Brian Ford. He's from Cambridge University. He's got a very interesting new theory there, as you heard, on intelligence. Okay, now... we're just going to go. We've one more guest, and before that, just to point out another item of news, this time from UCD. I saw that UCD reported, University College Dublin, drug being developed, that's this week, to tackle CJD. That's obviously that horrible brain disease linked, so-called mad cow disease, that could also help to block Alzheimer's. This is research that has been going on for some time by Professor Dominic Walsh and others. And if they can actually develop a drug that can tackle CJD, they feel, because there's similar mechanisms involved, that this could also help to block the development of Alzheimer's. Of course, one of the things then that is very important is that they find a way to diagnose Alzheimer's at a very early stage, because unfortunately, by the time symptoms come along, it's often too late, really, to make much of a difference. Even if you halted the disease at that particular point, a lot of the damage has been done. Okay, now for our final guest, we're going to talk about electric cars. What is the future for electric cars in Ireland? Well, to talk about this, I've Declan Nguyen. He's the general manager of a company called Gale Tech. They just won a contract to install electric car power points, in homes from the ESB. Welcome to the programme, Declan.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now I know that the government, it's actually quite surprising that the government have a target that they want 10% of all cars to be electric by 2020. That seems very ambitious, or you'd probably argue otherwise.
Yes, in fact, Sean, I would, and probably a short time ago we may have all thought it was very much an ambitious target, but we'll see as months move forward, and we've seen some huge milestones achieved in recent weeks alone in this country in terms of electric transportation, and I do believe the target of 1 in 10 vehicles on the road being electrified by 2020 is a realistic target for this country.
Okay, maybe tell us where we stand as of now then. In terms, I suppose the first thing a lot of people will think of, it might be unfair, is that electric cars are very slow and they mightn't have much performance, and also that the batteries in them, they don't allow you to travel that far before you need to recharge. So what kind of state is the technology at the moment?
The technology has advanced reasonably well in recent years, and although there is some concerns with regards to the battery life in terms of the journeys that can be got out of electric vehicles, the driving experience is actually quite good. I've had the pleasure to drive electric vehicles on a number of different occasions, and they stack up quite well in comparison to conventional vehicles on the road in terms of comfort, in terms of speed, and in terms of size. We're talking about a 5-seater vehicle that has a top speed of 140 kilometres with a journey distance on a battery life of 160 kilometres.
Very good. So
absolutely a good drive.
Yeah, it would seem then that really Ireland might be a good market, because I know it's a small market, but I mean the country is so small that if you're travelling within Ireland, you'd certainly have enough for one journey, even if you're going a fair distance.
Absolutely, there's out of a battery life of 160 kilometres, the average car owner would get quite a few journeys on an average week out of that battery life. And yes, you're very right in saying, as a small nation here, we have a great opportunity to take full advantage of electrified transportation, and due to our resource in terms of our wind resource in this country, I think it could be a really good thing for the country going forward.
Okay, and just one other question on that before we get on to your own company. Do you think that maybe there'll be, maybe they're here already, hybrid cars in between, say, electric and petrol, you know, that might be the way to go initially before there's a big transition?
We have had experience of hybrids in the country already, and there are quite a few out there, although I do believe, because of the running cost of electric vehicles, that they will be much more popular going forward. And from a cost point of view, they're a major advantage, the total operating cost of electric vehicle comparison to a conventional petrol engine is considerably cheaper, and I think there'll be a huge uptake on them due to that reason alone.
Okay, well, let's say I wanted to get a car tomorrow. Let's say the 5-seater that you mentioned, you know, the one that was fairly comfortable. How much is that going to cost me, and what do I need to do to actually get my PowerPoint installed?
The cost of electric vehicles vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, as I'm sure you can appreciate. But if we were to talk about an average five-seater vehicle and the one that we launched last week, you're talking 37,000 as the cost of the vehicle, with 5,000 government incentive there, which reduces that down to 32,000. Mm-hmm. And we must bear in mind that the running cost of the vehicle is exceptionally low. We're talking on average a yearly running cost of just over 200 euros, which leaves it at approximately 20 euros a month running cost, which is quite good.
Very good.
Especially with the increases in fuel prices of late.
And tax and insurance, while we're on the finance subject?
Insurance, there's no difference in terms of insurance, and the taxation for those vehicles is of a very low level, 104 euros a year for the tax. So
okay. There may be people that would still think that 32 grand is quite a lot, but I suppose, you know, your initial investment, you'll make it up, but I'd imagine the prices will probably go down further.
As demand kicks in, I'm sure, like everything, subject to demand, the prices should go down in time to come. But once you factor in the running costs of the vehicle, it's much more efficient, and it's much more cost effective to have an electric vehicle as opposed to a petrol or, in fact, a diesel engine.
Okay, now tell us about Gaeltacht Utilities. You're in Kilkenny, I believe, and you got this contract from the ASB to install home charge points nationwide for electric cars. So how valuable a contract? How many of these are you going to put in?
Well, the installation is subject to, obviously, the demand and in the market in terms of the sales of electric vehicles and what effectively happens. We've recently won the contract to install the domestic home charge points. And the domestic home charge points is the most cost-effective and efficient way to charge your electric vehicle. You plug it in overnight and it charges your vehicle, or, in fact, during the day. But for a long period of time, we're talking 6 to 8 hours of a charge duration, and it takes very little to charge in terms of electrical consumption, and you get your battery life out.
And is it outside? Do you plug it in outside, or do you have to run it in through a window? Or
yes, no. In fact, if you were to buy an electric vehicle tomorrow, you would then contact ESB to get your charge point installed. Subsequently, we have a contract with the ESB to install the domestic charge point. We would come out to your house and fit the small unit mounted on the walls on a garage or somewhere of convenience, so that you could plug in your vehicle and charge it as you wish.
Okay, well, listen, best of luck with it, and I hope it goes well. Anybody that's interested, Gaeltacht, they can look that up, I guess, online, and and take it from there. Thanks very much for coming on, Declan, and telling us about electric cars and where we stand on that. That's Declan Wynn. He's with Gaeltacht Utilities Limited in Kilkenny. They're installing power points for electric cars. Okay, that's all we have time for this week, so thanks for listening. To listen to previous shows, I'll just mention and find out what's happening in science in Ireland and around the world, you can visit my blog, which is Science Spinning at SeanDuke.com, I should say. And also the magazine I'm involved with, Science Spin, Ireland's only popular science magazine, at sciencespin.com. I'd be delighted to hear from listeners if you've any comments on the show, or if you've a science story to tell. Why not contact me at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. And meanwhile, have a good week. Talk to you again at 3:30 next Thursday for another installment of Science Spinning.